This recording follows the recording of the preface from the book Longing for Limitless Light by C.R. Lama and James Lowe. Introduction. The light of awareness is like the sun in the ever-open sky. Light shines forth, bringing illumination. If we see without looking for things, we will see that we see patterns of colour and light. This is the clarity or bright display which arises as the pure Buddha realms. The Buddha Amitabha, Upame, limitless light, resides in Sukhavati, Dewa Chen, the happy. At the beginning of his career as a bodhisattva, the universal emperor Wheel Rim, as Amitabha was then, made a vow that he would accumulate so much merit that by the mere remembrance of him or his name, any being would be reborn close to him in his Buddha realm, where their progress to enlightenment would be easy. To long for limitless light is to long for enlightenment, to reside at the very source of light. For most of us, simply becoming light is too subtle because of the opacity and density of our habits. Therefore, the great vow of Amitabha, limitless light, has provided us with a wonderful halfway house, his own happy realm, where we can be purified on ever more subtle levels by his presence and instructions. How wonderful to be in a realm where every occurrence is an encouragement to awakening. The sequence of texts in this book provides a progressive path for freeing ourselves from the sorrow-inducing delusions of being a separate entity, burdened with inherent existence. By developing faith that deepens and widens into an uninterrupted confidence, free of the turbulence of hopes and fears, we are released from the imprisoning power of our own thoughts. Thoughts, feelings, sensations, memories, and so on arise and pass with no inherent power to limit us. It is our own belief in the substantial reality and truth of our mental experiences that gives them their power. Faith and devotion allow us to shift our reliance away from both the outer, reified objects of the world and the inner concepts shaping our dualistic intentions. Releasing the energy of our mind from its fixations, it is freed to be in the service of awakening rather than maintaining the limitations of samsara. Doubt, hesitancy, and uncertainty are great enemies for those seeking liberation from duality. Being in two minds about something feeds the separation of self and other, subject and object, and this leads to further fragmentation of self and world. So we need to gather ourselves into one pointed attention so that we can remain focused on our path and goal and resist all temptation to distraction. The texts offered here provide a way to remove both the obscuration of the root afflictions, opacity, desire, aversion, pride, and jealousy, and the obscuration of cognizing things. Moreover, they provide the basis for gathering the two accumulations of merit and wisdom, which give us access to the realms of purity. The first text is the short Refuge and Bodhicitta, given on page 17. The Buddhas always offer refuge, so it is always available, whenever we turn towards them. We are saying, I need your help, your protection, your inspiration. I want to be close to you. With their support, with the ongoing sense that there is a benign presence on my side, by my side, I can develop the courage to follow Amitabha in making the Bodhisattva vow and dedicating all my time, energy, and intention towards the benefit of others. More detail on this is available later in the sections on the Bodhisattva vow. But the key point at the beginning is the sense that Now my life is meaningful. The winds of desire and aversion that have us running towards our passing fancies and away from the emergent fears are forces of destabilizing intensity. We let go of this immersion in the carnival of human life and settle into confidence in being part of the great work of bringing all sentient beings to liberation. Then, on page 18, we have the first version of the seven-branch practice, which is contained in many of the texts in this volume. This version follows the method of offering employed by Bodhisattva Samantabhadra at the beginning of his career. His vision is so vast that it collapses all thought. His inconceivable generosity is to offer to as many Buddhas as there are particles of dust in the universe, each surrounded by just as many bodhisattvas, an amazing array of all that brings pleasure. Gift-giving is, amongst other functions, a way of making and deepening connection. And through following his method, we have a vast way of linking ourselves with all that is good and wholesome. We offer our salutations to all the pure ones, those rich in wisdom and compassion, and make our offerings. Trusting their non-judgmental kindness towards us, we offer confession, distancing ourselves from both outer negative acts and inner negative impulses. Then we rejoice in the virtue performed by others and the merit arising from it. This is the great antidote to pride and envy. Others practice virtue, not only us. If we can celebrate what they do, then we can relax and open to being a small rivulet joining in the great river of Dharma. Next, by asking of the Buddhas to teach the Dharma, we make our half of the bridge of transmission. Buddhism is not an evangelical religion. If the karmic connection is not ripe, then Dharma is unlikely to be of interest. And so we have to show our interest by requesting teaching. When the generous giver meets the grateful recipient, the circle is completed. Following this, we request the Buddhas not to die, not to leave, not to become unavailable. Although Buddhas are not impermanent, we are advised to think of them as passing on in order to avoid complacency. For worldly life, we need many things, and if one item is finished, we can always get another. But when a Buddha leaves the world, it is a great loss, and the periods between one Buddha and the next can be very long. The Dharma can stand in the place of the Buddha, yet we still need a teacher or guru to make it come alive for us. Finally, there is the seventh branch. The dedication of the merit arising from the previous six branches, along with all other merit we have for the sake of all beings. Beings in the three lower realms of hells, hungry ghosts and animals have very little capacity to create merit, while beings in the god realms are preoccupied with pleasure, and the jealous gods are consumed with jealousy. We human beings have great opportunities, yet they are easily lost. Merit is the ethical and spiritual value generated by good actions. It is not a substance, yet it can be thought of as if it were, in order to give us the sense that this is a resource that can be accumulated and put to good use for the benefit of all. This is followed on page 34 by Honouring True Value, taken from Entering the Path of Enlightenment, by Shantideva. This famous, beautiful section supports us in making many further offerings to the Buddhas. The offerings conjure up a sense of ease and plenty, and so match the mind of the Buddha, which is always relaxed and full of beauty and light. We offer beauty in order to find our own beauty. For our confessions, we rely on the power of those we confess to, the Buddhas and great Bodhisattvas, for they can see our intrinsic purity, which for us is hidden at the moment, by our adventitious obscurations. We also rely on the power of effective application of the antidotes, the virtue and meditation. We invite the light of the Buddhas to flow into us and wash out all defilements and limitations so that we are translucent and sparkling like crystal glass. We activate the power of total renunciation, cutting ourselves free from the structures, beliefs and activity which have predisposed us to act in ways that were detrimental to the well-being of others and ourselves. Lastly, we employ the power of abandoning the return to error. We block the way back to worldliness by seeing the dangers that lie there and by emphasizing our commitment to change and by developing an unwavering alignment with the path to liberation. These are the famous four powers of purification, and they are vital for practice, as they wash away the glue of our identification with limiting patterns. Having prepared the ground, we move on to the specific preparations for taking the Bodhisattva vow, on page 56. To vow, from the depths of our heart, to work for the benefit of others, from now on until all beings are fully liberated, is profound and transforming, and therefore one should be aware of all that is involved. This is a vow that the ego cannot make. The ego says, "Me first." The Bodhisattva says, "You first." With this vow, our connection with all beings is illuminated, and our intention towards them starts to be purified of the distorting motives of the five afflicting poisons of opacity, aversion, desire, jealousy, and pride. This vow is too onerous to be carried by oneself alone, so we make it in front of all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, including our own gurus and teachers. We will need their ongoing support and companionship if we are to remain true to our vow and become an enlightening presence in the many realms of darkness. Therefore, we invite the Buddha to come with all his followers, and through offerings and praise, we bind ourselves to them. The term Bodhisattva indicates a being, Sattva, who is orientated towards awakening, Bodhi, for all sentient beings. The Bodhisattva's view is narrow in that she is not focused on worldly concerns, such as fame, wealth, or being liked. Yet her view is wide, indeed vast, because of her concern for the welfare of all beings, without exception. She has renounced the categories of friend and foe, liked and not liked, near and distant, helpful and unhelpful. However beings are, she is for them as they are. This amazing orientation rests on her capacity to perceive the seed of enlightenment in all beings. Whoever is sentient has a mind, and if the actual nature of the mind is seen, then that is itself the act of awakening. To take the Bodhisattva vow is to enter the company of the great beings who have renounced all selfish concerns and find their fulfillment in the welfare of others. On an outer level, this means providing food, shelter, medicine, and so on. On an inner level, it means staying present for the other, however they are, in their emotions, bigotry, and so on. On a secret or invisible level, it is simply staying open and without intention regarding whatever occurs. On this secret level, there is no longer striving for the benefit of others. Their benefit lies in effortless inclusion in the ever-bright Buddha mind. What we can do with the support of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is much more than what we can do on our own. In fact, the text is subtly pointing to the delusion of duality, to the separation of self and other. We are not, and never have been, separate from the Buddhas, nor from all sentient beings, nor from all that emerges. The Buddhas already always include us in their company, and now we include all beings in ours. The entities which constitute samsara are being softened, as we see that the fragmentation we experience is not intrinsic, but is simply the delusion arising from not seeing the light as light. Taking the Bodhisattva Vow, on page 74, sets out the actual ritual which you can use to take the vow. If possible, we receive the vow directly from someone who is fully in the practice and has previously received it from their teacher, so that the blessing of the entire lineage strengthens our own resolve. If this is not possible in person, then prepare a small shrine with an image of the Buddha and scatter it with flower petals, and open your heart to the ritual. Firstly, we recite prayers to the various lineages of the Bodhisattva vow. We call to mind all those who have gone before us in this great undertaking. May the power of their selfless intention feed our own, so that we will not falter in our commitment to always act for the benefit of others. The final guru in each of these lineages is Timurigsen, the great scholar and guru whom I assisted in the translation of these texts. Having recollected our debt of gratitude to these great beings for having sustained the lineage so that we can now be supported by it, we direct the merit arising from this remembrance towards the flourishing of the Dharma. Dharma, the teachings and practices of Buddhism, is not something out there that will survive and thrive by itself. At this time of great change and increasing anxiety, the calming clarity of Dharma could be of great benefit to many. The presence of the Dharma is nourished by our faith, devotion, and energy. Without this, on a relative level, it will weaken and fade. Although on an absolute level, Dharma is unchanging and freely available in all times and places, in our world of duality, the polarity of increase-decrease is in play. And so, if we do not offer our life energy to Dharma, it will not be available in future for ourselves and for others. Thus we can see that, even as beginners, our love and kindness can fuel the flames of Dharma, which burn up all obscurations and ignorance, and illuminate the path to freedom. Then we again take refuge to link ourselves with the truly virtuous. We strengthen this by expressing our commitment to renounce harming others in any way, and to focus on practicing virtue with our body, speech, and mind. Selfishness and self-cherishing have become so habitual for us that we believe our ego identity to be the truth of how we actually are. In fact, the ego is not a thing, but a way of patterning experience around the delusion of a continuous self-entity. Hence, it is necessary to outwardly shift our behaviour away from its function of affirming our self as an existent entity, and to inwardly shift our thoughts and feelings away from self-confirmation, and, more deeply, to dissolve our self-reflexive consciousness in the ocean of awareness. The central practice of taking the Bodhisattva vows begins on page 106 with our direct request to the officiating teacher to raise within us the altruistic intention to gain unsurpassed, supreme, and complete enlightenment. They know how to raise this intention, and we are going to learn from them. Again and again in this book, we are encouraged to rely on the three jewels, to learn from the experience of the wise, and to follow this well-trodden path. Inclusion, membership, participation, and belonging constitute this path. Having lost our way in the jungle of samsara, it is only sensible to rely on the experienced guides who can point the way, Life is too short to keep entering dead ends in this labyrinth of karmic patterns. The actual vow has various stages. Firstly, we develop the bodhicitta of aspiration, a wish to become a bodhisattva, a being, sattva, who works for the enlightenment, bodhi, of all, on page 109. This is often compared to how we prepare for going on a journey. We gather information about the destination, collect what we might need for the journey, and ready ourselves for the challenges which might occur, particularly those manifesting from our fears, laziness, and lack of belief in the fundamental goodness of ourselves and all beings. Just as all bodhisattvas have done at the beginning of their careers, we express our intention to free all beings by taking them out of samsara and to give hope and confidence to all so that they can pass from suffering. How vast and comprehensive this vow is. How amazing that we can aspire to such a task. The aspiration itself begins our rebirth as we let go of our worldly concerns and become focused on the welfare of others. The second stage is the bodhicitta, the mind, citta, of awakening, bodhi, manifesting as engagement in actual practice, on page 115. Now we're on the journey. We have left the familiar landmarks that remind us of our samsaric identity and are starting to find our way in the openness of the limitless path accommodating all beings. We commit to the actual training taken on by all bodhisattvas. In particular, we commit to training in the six paramita, or transcendent qualities, of generosity, morality, patience, diligence, meditation, and true discernment. The first five qualities developed in the service of others become transcendent through the presence of the sixth. True discernment is the acuity, the bright sharpness of the mind that reveals the absence of inherent existence in phenomena. All that appears, whether seemingly material or mental, is empty of self-substance, self-existence, and self-identity. All occurrence is like a dream. Something seems to be experienced, and yet no thing has actually been experienced. This is the key quality that differentiates the great vehicle, Mahayana, from the lesser vehicle, Hinayana. Only the mind inseparable from emptiness is vast enough to encompass the welfare of all beings. Our human ego self striving to do its best will only ever have limited capacity, since, although it may see the absence of inherent existence in beings, it cannot let go of the idea of fundamental entities. This dualistic reliance is its inherent structural limitation, restricting both wisdom and compassion. The third stage is developing the absolute bodhicitta, page 121. Here, absolute refers to sky-like emptiness, free of reification, objectification, and duality. From the very beginning, there has been not one atom of real existence. All beings are inseparable from the ever-open ground, the unborn presence of ungraspable spaciousness. All beings are essentially Buddhas because it is the awakening to this unborn ground that marks the birth of each unborn Buddha. We are already in the Buddha mandala, yet we cannot see this due to our unborn obscurations. Neither beings, nor obstacles, nor awakenings, nor Buddhas really exist. This is the absolute bodhicitta. The three stages of the bodhisattva vows have been engaged with. There follows reiteration of the key points in the Unified Teaching for Simple People, page 122. Even if life is very busy or difficult, whatever we do and whatever happens to us, if we simply maintain recollection of our vow and include the welfare of all in our every experience, rejoicing in their virtue and dedicating all merit to others, this will be sufficient. Then, on page 125, we recite verses which remind us of our new identity and the new values and tasks that come with it. The verse on page 130 is particularly illuminating of our new orientation. Whenever I am glad, I will dedicate that joy to the happiness of all beings. May their happiness fill the sky. Whenever I get trouble, I will take the suffering of all beings as my own burden. May the oceans of suffering become dry. This is a beautiful expression of the principle of giving one's happiness to others and taking on their suffering. To give one's happiness to others may seem reasonable and virtuous, but to intensify one's own misery by adding the troubles of all beings to my own may seem punitive. It is here that we have to remember the absolute bodhicitta. All suffering is empty of inherent existence. The kindness of alleviating the suffering of others, if it is vast and unconditional, will bring with it the loosening of egoic self-referencing and the consequent revelation of the ungraspability of all experience. The next section, page 133, Honouring the Buddha's Speech, highlights the ungraspable nature of all experience as it actually is. This is the wisdom of emptiness which the Heart Sutra makes available to each of us. Firstly, there is a tantric-style practice which brings us into direct communication with Buddha Shakyamuni. We're not just thinking about or talking about the Buddha. We are entering into his unmediated presence. This shift is enacted through the purifying and equalizing mantra, which indicates Om, pure nature. All phenomena have very pure nature. This is my nature. On the basis of this, all conceptualized forms are resolved into their open ground. Within this vast, expansive space, by saying Om Mani Padme Hum, I arise as Chenrezig, the bodhisattva particularly associated with compassion, and in this form I attend to the words of pure Dharma streaming from Buddha Shakyamuni. Thus the Heart Sutra arises, and I, as Chenrezig, participate in its unfolding. In this way, the revelation of true Dharma is appearing here and now, as direct contact with the source of clarity. The Heart Sutra has a simple structure, and its words make clear that whatever is taken to be separate and really existing is actually always inseparable from and non-dual with ungraspable no-thingness. All that we know, see, taste, remember, and so on is actually not what we take it to be. It is our deluded perception which generates the illusion of separate entities, including ourselves. When this unnecessary excessive effort is given up, there is the naked simplicity of empty appearance. The less we do, the more the actual is revealed. It is revealed not as a work in progress, but as always already complete. When this is clear, the egoic formation is redundant and dissolves. Honouring the Buddha's speech concludes with some verses highlighting the power of emptiness to overcome all difficulties and render all negative forces ineffective. The verse that begins at the bottom of page 159 is a beautiful summation of the dereification of all phenomena. All the appearances that we take to be fixed entities are in fact dynamic moments of experience, which arise in collaboration with other moments of experience. They originate or arise or display, dependent on the origination or arising or display of other aspects of the field of occurrence. The tree arises due to the soil, the rain, the sun, the absence of the chainsaw, and so on. There is no self-existing tree. Thus, the key organizing binaries of stopping and starting, annihilation and permanence, coming and going, diverse meanings, and one fixed meaning, are all groundless, being mere concepts without actual referent. To see this is to observe all the concepts you have used to construct your world, losing their life force. This life force was nothing other than your belief in them. When the emptiness of these beliefs is seen, everything is pacified, and the mind is at ease. Following this, we have two prayers to ripen the mood of trust and devotion, which is vital for arriving in Dewa Chen and seeing Amitabha. Devotion begins with inspiration as we gain the vivid faith of appreciation of the good qualities of the object of our yearning. This appreciation and inspiration make us aware of the gap between where we are and where we want to be. This feeds our faith and eager aspiration to strive to end suffering and gain liberation. With this, we can develop the faith of certainty, or full confidence in the teachings, and with that we find a commitment to empty samsara. Your heart opens, and judgment falls away, so that your separation from the Dharma diminishes as irreversible faith is born. These four aspects of faith support each other and help to keep us on track. The first short prayer on page 162 is a reminder of the great yogis and scholars who established the Dharma in Tibet. Without their effort and generosity, we would not be able to access the teachings. So, whether we know a lot or a little about the history of Buddhism in Tibet, we owe a debt of gratitude to these great ones. And so this prayer lets us express this. To recognize our dependence on the good works of others is no diminution of ourselves. To depend on others is to be part of the unfolding field of revelation. We take our place within it through our devotion. How much sweeter to become part of the open Buddha field than to be endlessly ploughing our own deep furrow. The second prayer on page 167 is by Padmasambhava and revealed as a treasure text by Chökyö Dzogchen Lingpa. It includes the seven-branch practice that has occurred in earlier texts and builds on this to make aspirations for success in learning and for the long life and good health of the teachers who illuminate the world with the precious teachings. Teachers, students, sponsors, yogis, so many personalities, skills, interests and energies go towards creating and sustaining a flourishing Dharma culture. In the West, this process is just beginning as fragile shoots of study and practice start to extend roots downwards. This whole endeavor depends on goodwill, a profound commitment to the common good and the benefit of all. As we know, conflicts arise easily in human society. The concept of shared humanity has not been strong enough to end wars and exploitation. The concept of Buddhism or Buddha Dharma has not been strong enough to prevent sectarian rivalries and hostility. Separation and differentiation is rapidly followed by hierarchical ordering, leading to pride and jealousy. This brief prayer by the great lotus born is an encouragement to inclusivity, fellow feeling, and benefit of all, free of the fragility of dependence on concepts. From page 176 to page 306, there are a series of aspirations for being born in the Buddha realm of Amitabha, known as Dewa Chen in Tibetan, and Sukhavati in Sanskrit. This name translates as Happy Land, or simply Happy. As Appendix 1 on page 230 points out, this realm of Dewa Chen was generated by the fulfillment of the vow made by the Universal Emperor Huil Rim. He vowed that as a result of his diligent practice, he would accumulate sufficient merit to manifest the highest Buddha realm. Moreover, whoever remembers me and my name and realm, or hears of them, will not be born again, but will come to my realm. If this does not occur, then I will not become a Buddha. The word of a Buddha is Vajra, indestructible. Whatever is said must come to pass. This great king, Huil Rim, is stating that if his words are not fulfilled, he will not enter enlightenment. The power of the spoken word used to be considered to rest in its truth and reliability. My word is my bond. Nowadays, when lying and spin seem to be inseparable from power, it can be difficult for us to comprehend the power of truth and the power of the commitment to the fulfillment of an aspiration. To make a vow to all beings, for all time, is to step free of strategy and tactics. The path is straight and clear, to free oneself from selfishness and judgment, and to work for the benefit of all. To follow this is to approach ever closer to the honour and dignity of the Buddha. Due to the fulfillment of his vow, the Universal Emperor, Huil Rim, became the Buddha Amitabha, residing in Dewa Chen, the Buddha realm his merit has generated. Such is the power of his vow that even today, total reliance on his name and presence acts as a ring of faith by which his hook of compassion can catch us and bring us to Dewa Chen. We can ripen our faith by developing the four causes for being born in Dewa Chen. These are given on page 231. Firstly, we need to learn of the good qualities of this Buddha realm. Otherwise, why would we want to go there? We need to be clear that it is much superior to the god realms within samsara. Secondly, we need to accumulate much merit through the practice of virtue and the avoidance of non-virtue. The practice of virtue helps us to become simple and straightforward, with less to hide and less need to pretend. We gain the dignity of open presence, of being available to and for others, with a heart full of affection and a mind suffused with active kindness. The seven-branch practice, presented in various forms in this book, is a key method for doing this. Our recollection of the generosity of the Buddhas and our gratitude for all they bring to our lives is strengthened by offering them reverent salutation, myriad offerings, and the confession of our faults and limitations. With this, we can rejoice in the virtue done by others, request the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to teach, and not to become unavailable for us. By dedicating the merit of this for the benefit of others, we diminish our selfishness and increase our loving concern. The third cause of gaining birth in Dewa Chen is the generation of an altruistic intention towards enlightenment. The motive of seeking only one's own liberation is like a feeble torch on a dark night. If we want to enter the realm of limitless light, we need to generate a bright light in our own heart, the light of love and commitment to the well-being of all, unconditional and without judgment. The fourth cause is to dedicate all the merit of all that we have ever done to the benefit and enlightenment of all beings. Without keeping even one atom of merit for ourselves, if our intention is totally altruistic, then we will find that we actually have all the merit needed to live and thrive in Dewa Chen. The aspiration that brings birth in Dewa Chen, on page 176, begins by describing the location of Dewa Chen. It is to be found far, far to the west, beyond innumerable lands. We cannot travel there by walking, by car, by plane. The only vehicle that will bring us there is the union of Amitabha's vow and the adequacy of our four causes. It lies to the west, which is also the direction of the section in the mandala where Amitabha resides, the arena of the purification of desire, where each appearance is clearly discerned exactly as it is. Generally, love is blind and desire is blind because they are over-focused on the objects of our selective attention. Panoramic appreciation reveals the specific display of each aspect of the field of clarity, the field of limitless light. The beauty of the environment in this Buddha realm is highlighted so that all its charming qualities can arouse in us a great and one-pointed yearning to go there. What in samsara could compare with such beauty? A beauty that effortlessly encourages awakening. In samsara, beauty is a restricted commodity, and this gives rise to desire, ambition, selfishness, and hostility. But in Dewa Chen, everything is light and bright, facilitating ease and attention, free of desire and appropriation. Our birth there is magical as we manifest in the center of a lotus. This pure birth is a true rebirth, and all our old self-centered habits are left far behind. There is no need for womb birth, and so no one there has a female body. There is no sexual desire and no competition. How different that would be from the world we know. With constant remembrance of the marvellous qualities of this realm of pure light, may it guide our actions in this life, so that everything we do prepares us for birth there. A swift path to cross easily to the excellent realm, on page 187, offers a complete practice to achieve our goal. Each text, focused on Dewa Chen, has its own mood and style, which helps us to find the form of this aspiration that is most fitting with our current circumstances. With the swift path, we have the Dharani or long mantra of the offering cloud, on page 190, which increases the volume, variety, and purity of the offerings we make. The Mahayana view is vast. We fill the sky with offerings to myriad Buddhas filling the sky, and then dedicate the merit for the well-being of all. Vast and inclusive, generosity, love and compassion are freely available to all, regardless of their qualities. This view takes us away from the reward approach of narrowly considering cause and effect. We share the merit equally with all, with persecutors and with victims, with predators and with their prey. Good and bad are relative terms. Awakening is awakening from the relative and the dualized to the absolute and the non-dual. When we directly open to non-duality, we see that there are no really existing entities, no actual people who are truly good or bad. All that appears is the radiance or clarity of the openness of presence. On page 233, there is a further method of accumulating merit, the offering of food. We offer what we have actually assembled, as well as all that we can imagine, We are asking the Buddhas for help. Help to escape the endless suffering of samsara. This is a big request. Luckily for us, they are willing and happy to connect with us and help us. We offer food in order to give us the confidence that we have something to offer. This is actually just a comforting notion to ease our ego in its sense of its own lack. In fact, we are totally reliant on the kindness of the Buddha. Why is this? The Buddhas see the actual, while we imagine the deceitful to be true. We deceive ourselves and others with our mistaken beliefs in the true existence of people and things. Living in the hazy maze of deception, we cannot find a way out. The exit does not lie in concepts, in memories, in plans, nor in any of the other transient contents of the mind. We need the help of the Buddhas. They do not need our offerings. The less pride we have, the less defended we are, and so are able to lessen the strength of our assertions of true existence. Then we have more space to receive the light of the Buddhas into our hearts. It is the light of the Buddha that lets us see that we also are Buddhas. Being uncertain of being loved, we make offerings to try to ensure that the Buddhas will be willing to think of us. This is a transaction or deal that we, as ego self, need to make. It's not required by the Buddhas. How generous they are to meet us within the drama of our illusory existence. Like a child's make-believe tea party, we pour imaginary tea and eat imaginary cakes, telling each other how good they are. But at least, with this benign mental activity, we open the way to belonging and to free participation. On page 237, we have the famous De Chen Mon Lam, the aspiration to reach Dewa Chen, written by Raga Asya. Clearly written in a very inviting style, the text draws us into an exquisite vision of the life we will lead once we depart this life in the certainty of taking lotus birth in Amitabha's Buddha realm. He begins by helping us to imagine Amitabha and his entourage, and how Amitabha is ceaselessly looking with compassion at all sentient beings in their diverse activity. This gaze manifests as his Sambhogakaya form, Chenrezig, or Avalokiteshvara, whose quick eye sees all the suffering of samsara. He also manifests Aryatara and Padmasambhava. These three active saviours, the warmth of the lotus family, also radiate out countless forms to move in samsara, bringing comfort and encouragement to all. All our thoughts, words and actions are known by Amitabha, for we are all already included in his enveloping care. Trusting this allows us to relax, cease from striving, and start to receive the love that has always flowed from the heart of the Buddha. After an extensive seven-branch practice, we prepare ourselves for our journey to Dewa Chen. At precisely the moment of death, as our consciousness eases free of its embodiment, we find Amitabha present before us, ready to safely guide us to Dewa Chen. May we be happy to go there and easily resist being deflected to any of the six realms of samsara, where only sorrow would await us. Yet old habits die hard, and we have had many, many lifetimes of deceiving ourselves with the belief that transient moments of happiness could be made permanent. Seeing that all these lives, with their hopes and fears, have been nothing more than dreams, we can let them go and turn towards the permanent satisfaction of awakening. All beings who are born there are born from a lotus. But if one has doubted that one would actually be born there, then the petals of the lotus remain closed, and one must wait 500 years before they open. One will still be able to hear Amitabha teaching and will have no suffering except the frustration of not being able to see this blessed land. Doubt, hesitation, anxiety, and uncertainty are signs of being in two minds, being divided in oneself. And this inner splitting maintains the structure of duality, and so is a great impediment. Life in Dewa Chen, on page 282, is easy, pleasurable, and fulfilling. Freed from the many tasks necessary for survival in samsara, our attention is available for deep study and practice, both of which are now easy to engage with. Raghahasya goes on to describe many beautiful features of the easy path to awakening that is available there. He has written this text for us as a concise summary of several sutras. His sources are reliable. His writing is clear. It is up to us to put it into practice. This text is followed by two short texts by Mingyur Dorje on page 301, which provide succinct summaries of the essence of this view. If we have become familiar with the longer texts, then these two brief summations can maintain our pure intention when we are pressed for time. Mingyur Dorje's words help to transform worldly, dualistic longing into the profound emotion of one-pointed longing for light. The book comes to an end with prayers for the flourishing of the Dharma, with reminders of the depth and variety of the teachings. May there be peace in the world for all beings, with freedom from war, illness, and catastrophe. May all have the wish to practice Dharma and the opportunity to fulfill that wish. It is wonderful that links to the recordings are being shared so widely. However, in sharing a file, information on the website may be missed. So here are some details, which may fill in some gaps. You will find the preface on simplybeing-sw.co.uk under audio video at the top of the page, along with James's introduction to the recordings, and further recordings will be added here as they are completed. This website links with simplybeing.co.uk, where other work and teachings of James Lowe can be accessed. It's good to read the preface first, but either way, it's valuable for James's brief and profound explanation, as well as other information you'll find there. You'll also find details of a request to respect the author's rights. In brief, the copyright states that any kind of reproduction or utilization or incorporation into storage retrieval systems is prohibited without written permission from James Lowe. Longing for Limitless Light is recorded by Wendy in 2022.